Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So James, we have a crunch talks day in the Brexit negotiations. Explain what's happening.
For once, this really is a crunch day. Theresa May is off to Brussels where she is having lunch with Jean-Claude Juncker and then tea or coffee with Donald Tusk later on. And this is so important because it essentially determines whether the Commission will turn around to the Council and say, yes, I think there has been sufficient progress to move on to the next stage of the talks. And if the EU says there hasn't been sufficient progress in December, I think the UK government will probably walk away from the table. Theresa May will certainly come under incredible pressure to do so. It looks like there is agreement on the money. It looks like the UK offer to pay 40-odd billion has dealt with that. On citizens' rights, it looks like everybody apart from the European Parliament seems pretty happy with it. The UK is making quite a large concession, saying that the UK Supreme Court will refer cases to the ECJ when it's unclear what European law says about the subject where there's no case law. But the big sticking point is the Irish border. And there have been some kind of relatively dramatic developments this morning, which RTE, or the Irish broadcaster, are reporting is basically saying no regulatory divergence on the island of Ireland, which seems to suggest, you might say, that Northern Ireland is de facto staying in the single market and the customs union. When I just read the leaked draft text just now, I didn't think it was quite as all-encompassing as that. And it might come down to this difference in how the UK government and the Irish government interpret the kind of North-South agreement in the Good Friday deal. So, but I think the signs at the moment are, going into lunch, and a lot can go wrong with Theresa May over lunch, is that we are probably heading towards sufficient progress or towards the Commission saying to the Member States, I think it is time to move on today. But I think it's worth remembering, A, no deal's done, as many as slipped with its cup and lip. And also, the UK government remains very burned by what it feels happened to it in October, when it feels that Michel Barnier and his team said, say this stuff about the money and that'll be enough to move on. They said the stuff verbatim about the money, and it turned out that wasn't enough. So I think you won't see any triumphalism at all from the UK government until this is all locked down in writing.
Katie, it is in the Commission's interests to move this on and to secure an agreement. James says that the British government could walk away from this, but that's not something that the Commission would want, presumably.
It's not something they'd want, but also I think this is a case, you know, who's going to blink first. And it definitely isn't in anyone's interest for there to be a no deal as things stand. But it's whether if Britain does walk away and if people start preparing for a no deal, it hurts both sides. But the question is probably, could the EU side sweat it out a bit more easily than Britain if businesses start ticking that box for their contingencies plans, which is what they might start to do if they really do think we're going to a no-deal scenario and they don't think that's been managed in a way which makes them feel reassured, then that is the point where the British government come under huge pressure if they've walked away. Do they walk back because businesses start to leave, or do they stick around and, you know, start to convince? And it could be one of those things where it could work either way, but it could actually weaken the hand of Brits further.
And James, in terms of the negotiations with the Irish government, they have been very up and down in terms of the comments that have been made in public, let alone those in private. Where are we now in terms of those discussions?
Well, I think Donald Tusk went to Dublin on Friday and delivered some very punchy words about how the EU would have Dublin's back in these negotiations, how, you know, the future of Britain's relationship with Europe depends on Ireland now and all this stuff. And everyone said, oh my word, look at how the Europeans are laying down the law. I read that slightly differently, because one of the things that needs to happen is the Irish need to be assured that when the talks move on to trade in phase two, the rest of the EU won't say, oh, you're Ireland, you're not one of the big EU players, and start ignoring their concerns. So the more the EU reassures the Irish that their interests will continue to be taken account in phase two, the more likely I think it is that the Irish say, okay, we'll move on to phase two. So I think there's a little bit of the more bellicose the language from Brussels towards the UK about how the UK must do the right thing by Ireland is, in some ways, the more likely it is that the Irish will say, OK, we can move on to phase two.
And Katie, in terms of the mood at home, how are Conservative MPs reacting to the way Theresa May is conducting the negotiations so far?
I think the Brexit bill has gone down reasonably well. Maybe well is the wrong word, a bit too enthusiastic, but it hasn't created the big row that some people thought it was, and also some people seem to be looking for. But the issues which really do worry certain MPs, particularly those who campaign for Leave with certain messages, is what role the ECJ will have. If you take EU citizens' rights and you refer them, then... And the ECJ has a place, and they worry that that is a way for the ECJ to keep, you know, having jurisdiction and ruling over the UK. And I think that's a big concern, and obviously the Irish border. So I do think there's a feeling, and we saw it at the weekend for some of the reports, that some of the Brexiteers are getting ready to speak out about these red lines being crossed. But at the same time, I think there's the other side of the government side who are a little bit jittery, as James has written on Coffee House, about whether they're going to get the green light. And I've noticed on one side, while you get the Brexit camp who are getting more anxious, there's also a shift. I would say there's more people who are acting like no deal is a very bad option than perhaps they were saying a month ago, when it was more game talk than something that might actually happen if this does go to pot.
And James, what about the mood in the cabinet?
I think the mood in the cabinet, I think it was telling that Jeremy Hunt on Sunday basically said, look, You've got to allow us to make some of these concessions or compromises, or you won't get any Brexit at all. I think, e.g., he was warning that in a no-deal scenario, it would be sufficiently unpredictable that you could see the government fall, and that could lead to a new government coming in that was certainly not committed to leaving both the single market and the customs union. I think Katie is right about the anxiousness about the ECJ, which is there in cabinet as well. But I think the crucial question is this ECJ a one-off to deal with the citizens' rights issue, the way to kind of grandfather that problem in, or is this a kind of beachhead for further ECJ involvement? At every point when the talks get tricky, are the EU negotiators going to turn around and say, that voluntary referral thing you did on citizens' rights, let's do that on this aspect of trade, let's do that on this aspect. So I think that's all to come. But the one thing I would say is, for however excited everyone is getting today, however dramatic today is, the really big stuff is yet to come, which is all in phase two, which is about the trade deal. Now, Theresa May has promised the cabinet, or certainly the Brexit inner cabinet, that they will have a full-on, no-holds-barred discussion on the end state before Christmas, if sufficient progress is granted at the European Council. And that, I think, is going to be one of the most seismic cabinet meetings of recent times, because they will have to work out what relationship the UK wants with the European Union once it is outside the single market and the customs union. And there is a huge kind of range of options there, from being outside the single market and the customs union, but hugging them as close as possible from the outside, to, you know, full-on divergence. And I think that is going to be when the rubber really hits the road.
And just staying on the mood in the cabinet, Katie, it's not just over Brexit that there are still disagreements and tensions. There are also some splits over Damien Green's future.
We seem to be saying this for the past few weeks, but any day now, we might get the result of the cabinet investigation into allegations of misconduct by Damien Green. I think, obviously, we saw this on Friday when the police, well, former police officers leaked more details and gave, you know, on the record interviews, that there are serious questions about whether the police, well, they shouldn't be releasing these details. But now they're out there, you do have a split in the cabinet where some people think he is becoming a figure that is too much of a distraction and is actually perhaps an embarrassing figure to keep in the cabinet if you know these things. But then there are those who are happy to fall on their sword, such as David Davis.
David Davis is always sort of longing to find a sword, isn't he, fall on.
And he's found a cause, so... But yeah, David Davis, who obviously... So if she were to try and sack Damien Green, I think there would be a big disagreement in the cabinet, more than if she were to keep him, I think. But I think you've got to remember, David Davis may want Damien Green to stay, but so does Theresa May. It's her closest ally in cabinet, and unless she really has to get rid of him, she's going to keep him.
I think part of her problem comes down to where the bar currently is for asking people to go, which is that, you know, Michael Fallon was basically told he had to go because he couldn't tell Theresa May, but no one else would come forward and say anything. The worry about Damien Green is that Theresa May expends political capital on saving him, and then some other charge comes forward. There are also very senior people inside Downing Street who think that Damien Green has misled Theresa May about the pornography issue, And that is...
What about the nature of it?
Or? No, the existence of it. He obviously denies... So, I mean, we should just make it clear. He denies that he has ever watched or downloaded this stuff. I think there are people in Number 10 who feel that Damian Green, to preserve himself from embarrassment, didn't tell Number 10 what they think of as the most accurate version of events about the computer.
So there's a trust issue there. Is there anyone in Cabinet who really hates Damian Green and would like to get rid of him?
I think there are people who dislike him. That's certainly right. He's not wildly unpopular. I mean, there are people
he doesn't have a campaign against
everyone
him.
In Cabinet. I think I put it another way. There is a divide in Cabinet about how to treat this whole issue of the Robert Napoli has been labelled Pestminster. You know, those people who just think you just have to kind of ride this out. And that they basically kind of slightly raise an eyebrow at it and basically think the idea is to get through it. There are those people who think that the government has to be kind of on the front foot, always able to say that it is doing everything it can to clean house, etc., etc., etc. And I think that is where you see some of the tensions. I mean, context is everything. I think if it had come out that the police were alleging that Damian Green had watched porn on his office laptop 6 months ago, it would have been a bit embarrassing for Damian Green, but he could have weathered the storm. It's a totally different context now, because the context now is politics a hostile place for, or a difficult place for young people to work in because of the kind of sexual habits and practices of politicians? And that's where it's been seen. I think that's why Damian Green's allies are so keen to kind of turn the question back onto whether the police are behaving appropriately. Because if that's the question, his position is stronger than on the former.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And a reminder of our special subscription offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12 and a free limited edition Moleskine notebook. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer.